marriage. Actually, the Sanskrit word for marriage is vivaha, which literally means carrying away the bride. So, I hope you haven't eaten too much today. So, vaha in Sanskrit is to carry. Vaha, you may know the word vahana, which it becomes German wagen, as in Volkswagen. And V means away, like the Italians would say, via, via, get away. So, vivaha means literally to carry away. So it's interesting how in English we say to carry away the bride, and they have the same expression. That is the main word for marriage in Sanskrit, to carry away the bride. So, most people here are old enough to know that Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that from passion comes suffering, and from goodness, from virtue, comes happiness. So, actually, the whole philosophical impulse comes originally from the discovery that there is something which is real or true, which is not on the surface of life. There's something beneath the surface. And so, because if everything were exactly as it seems to our senses, there would be nothing to philosophize about. You just open your eyes and see exactly what everything is. So philosophy actually begins with the recognition that everything that we see and hear and taste and touch and smell, that's not the whole story. And also, so it's actually these contradictions which lead to, or paradoxes, which lead to a type of creative tension, the tension between the parents and the substance, reality, or the tension between something which appears to be pleasant, which actually has a negative consequence. So if it were the case that everything which appears to be pleasant or enjoyable actually was so at the end of the day, again, there'd be no need for philosophy. Your senses could tell you everything. If something feels good, it is good. If something doesn't feel good, it's not good. And so you could simply rely on your senses to give you accurate information about everything. You could understand everything simply by perceiving it. Your senses would tell you the whole story. So the whole point of thinking, a dying art, the whole point of thinking is that it's not the whole story, and that the senses are actually capable at times of giving us false information. It's like you have a relationship with someone and you find that everything they tell you is true. Number one, because they're honest. Number two, because they're intelligent. Some they're honest, stupid people that say a lot of wrong things. And there are intelligent, dishonest people that say a lot of wrong things. But if in a relationship you find that someone is both intelligent and honest enough to know what they don't know, intelligent enough to know what they don't know, then you trust that person. So in the case of the senses, I mean all of us, unless someone is like really young and inexperienced, we all should know by now that the senses often give us unreliable information. And actually the same is true for our emotions. I think it's obvious that all of us have experienced at times becoming angry and later regretting the anger. Not always, of course. But all of us have experienced emotions, whether it's anger or attachment or fear or confidence. All of us have experienced emotions that we eventually understood misled us in some way, and that our best understanding is different from what our emotions told us. So the senses, not only the senses, but the mind also, the seat of the emotions, are not always reliable. They're not always reliable. And therefore, there's a need for intelligence in order to drive safely in life. It's like, there's a reason why drunk people shouldn't drive, because their judgment is impaired. If senses are impaired, they're just impaired. So the same way, if one relies simply upon the senses, do you have to sit in the sun? Do you want to come sit in the shade? Cool down before it dries
up. Once it's finished, it's cool.
Yeah, yeah, why don't you come sit in the shade? You're going to be half dead by the time it rushes over. Yeah, if you want to sit in the shade, then yeah. And then when no extra cost to you. So the intelligence, therefore there's a need to be guided by one's clear intelligence. If the intelligence becomes a servant of the senses and mind, for example, if someone decides to rob a bank, someone has the bright idea to rob a bank, and then they use their intelligence, what's the best way to do it? How can I get away? And they start calculating and analyzing. So that's an example of intelligence being under the control of irrational emotions or the senses. So intelligence, this is the whole point, by the way, of Plato's Republic. That was the whole point. That there's intelligence, mind, senses, and ultimately it's the intelligence which has to govern. Just like in a community, if someone who's not intelligent governs those who are, then it's a disaster. So that's why Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita repeatedly describes Krishna consciousness as Buddhi Yoga. We keep ourselves connected to the truth, reality, because there's a sense in which when we're overcome by lust or greed or pride or just laziness, that we become disconnected. We lose our yoga. We become disconnected from the truth. And Krishna says the way to keep yourself always connected to the truth, which is I really am a spirit soul. I mean, we've heard that so many times. It can become just like a theological drone in your ear. But actually, it's true. I mean, the amazing thing is it's actually true. So we're not this body. We're actually spirit soul. And therefore, Krishna says we need to keep ourselves connected to that truth of our own existence by intelligence. So Krishna often in the Bhagavad Gita refers to Krishna consciousness as Buddhi Yoga, keeping yourself connected by intelligence. So marriage is not something which stands outside spiritual life. It's not a concession. Okay, it's like, okay, I'm 80% vegetarian, or I'm 70% a devotee, and I dabble in marriage on the side. And I traffic in conjugal relationships. The idea is that marriage is very much a part, it's a component of spiritual life. And actually, since the beginning of time, whatever that means, marriage has been an important component of the spiritual life of most human beings. Due to the prevalence of some level of material attachment and heterosexuality. So, throughout history, most people who practice spiritual life, most people that practice spiritual life have done so within marriage. And there's a perfect model. There's actually a perfect model because Krishna himself is a married man, at least in Dwarka. More of a flirt, I guess. He just plays the field in Vrindavan, but... But at least in Dwarka, Krishna is married. And Krishna, marriage is so important that when Krishna came to earth and he said, Dharma Samstapana Arthaya, the purpose of my descent into this world is to establish or reestablish Dharma, actual principles of civilized life. And therefore, Krishna consciously, intentionally, marries, actually, quite a few times. 16,108 times. Which is more, and that's even more than in Utah. So anyway.
Or ISKCON.
That's more than Utah. so or it's not so. So Krishna himself marries and personally sets the example. Personally sets the example. And goes through the normal dharma principles of married life. So of course he was also an ideal brahmachari in his youth with Sandeep and Aruna. And then Prabhupada also mentioned that of the Panchatattva, all five of them went through householder life. Or Chaitanya, Nityananda, Advaita, Gadadhar, Srivas, all of them at one point in their life married. And not only that, even the GBC of Gainesville at one point was married. So, those are the six most prominent examples in our life. So, give up on your other voice, man. So it's actually very important because it's an ashram. All four ashrams are ashrams. They're different strategies for different positions within which one practices spiritual life. So to be within a particular ashram, brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, so sort of gradually manifesting, gradually taking shape, or sannyas, they're all ashrams. They're all equally ashrams. So generally we may say that one is more advanced than another, but in fact, however many sannyasis there were in the world when the Panchatattva were married, still, from within that grihastha ashram, they were most advanced. So there's no hard and fast rule. It's not like, it's just, everybody is whoever you are, that's who you are. And so the beauty of Vedic culture is that anyone from any varna, or from any ashram, has the same opportunity to make spiritual progress if you take the opportunity. Every ashram is designed to facilitate spiritual progress. And so there's no absolute distinction or barrier. Everyone is a level playing field in a sense. So this marriage is very nice because there's actually two good devotees, intelligent devotees, and the purpose of marriage is to advance spiritually. I mean, obviously, generally, people get married because they feel it's more natural for them, and given their psychophysical nature, it's a more natural position from which to practice spiritual life. And so every ashram sort of molded on the nature of that person. So within householder life, practically within every ashram, there are competing forces. Like for example, if you're a sannyasi, someone's a sannyasi, the person is supposed to be really focused on spiritual life, and yet the Bhagavatam itself says that sannyas is sarvashrama namaskritam, but all the other ashrams bow to the sannyas ashram. So the idea of sannyasi, in principle, sannyasi is supposed to be advanced, and so therefore there's certain respect given. But that respect also is a temptation. You can't underestimate the seductive power of free lunches. But in any order of life, if one is offered a certain respect, especially sannyas life, and we've seen that people can be attracted to a particular ashram because they want the glamour that goes with it, or they want a certain status that goes with it. At different times in history, different ashrams have different appeal or have different values, under different historical circumstances. Times change, but still, in general, there were cases of, obviously many cases of people taking sannyas at times for the wrong reason, at times just with a lack of self-understanding. And so, every ashram has built-in facility and opportunity, and built-in temptation and danger. And so people get married because it's more natural for them to practice spiritual life within, as a couple. But then again, that also is a can be a temptation for material life in various ways. In fact, the Adhikari. Do you still use it? What? Brother Judith, is that still in use? Yeah, I guess for formal occasions. So, adhikara means a right. As in, like, for example, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, karma niva adhikara state. You have a right to perform your duty. So the word right is adhikara. And the word adhikara is interesting. Kara, of course, means to do, from the root kri, from which we get the English word create, or increase, Portuguese crescer. And so, kara means doing. Kara means doing, and adhi means above. Like Krishna says, mayantyakshena, by my oversight. So, adhi means above or over. So, doing from above, in other words, doing from a position of authority, acting from a superior position. That's literally what the word adhikara means, acting from a superior position. And therefore, the word adhikara means a right. In other words, you have a right to do something, you act from that position, authority. So adhikari obviously means someone who has that right. So, because if you think about it, if you think about traditional Vedic culture, just traditional God-conscious culture in any civilization, even religious culture, brahmacharis are celibate students, hopefully, and the vanaprasthas are retiring, the sannyasis are busy preaching and managing their stock portfolios, and so, but actually in traditional Vedic culture, the brahmacharis and brahmacharinis, the vanaprasthas and the sannyasis are all not so much engaged in sort of the nitty-gritty, heavy, you know, just managing the world. It's really the householders. It's really the householders who do the business, who do the world's business, who do the world's politics, and so on and so forth in general. It's really the householders, so therefore they're adhikari. Householders have a right to procreate children, so the future generations come from the householders. So in that sense, it's really the householders who have the adhikara, the right, or the authority within the Vedic system to fully engage in the world. Reproductively, financially, politically, and they're supposed to manage the world. So, in that sense, they're called adhikari. And precisely because of that privilege, or that opportunity, or that burden, or whatever you want to call it, of course, they have to deal with the world, there's all kinds of temptation and danger, just as there is in every other ashram. As there is in every other ashram. So, those who are getting married, they have to sort of have a good head on their shoulders. And it's not, we don't automatically remember Krishna. We don't automatically remember Krishna. Therefore, we practice bhakti yoga or sadhana bhakti. Because our spontaneous consciousness, if you think about it, let's say all the rules were lifted. If all the rules were lifted, and you could do anything with impunity, that means without being punished. If you could do anything, what if all the consequences for all acts were removed? So that no matter what you do, you get the same consequence. What would people actually do? Hold that thought. So, it's interesting. I mean, it's a question you could ask yourself. Like, to what extent am I like a laboratory rat just conditioned? Like, because I get certain rewards and punishments, therefore I practice certain spiritual principles. If all the rewards and punishments, if everything was removed, and you had to act only for the sake of the act itself, all the consequences for every action were equal, what would you do? And actually, Krishna talks about this in the Gita. Because there are several verses in the Gita where Krishna is describing a doer or action in the mode of good, three modes, including goodness and charity. And for action in the three modes, he says, Karyam iti jat karma kriyate anupakarita. In the mode of goodness, a person does something because it's the right thing to do, not regarding the consequences. Not regarding the consequences. So in true goodness, it's not like, hey, okay, I got it down now. If I act in this mode, I get better rewards than if I act in that mode. But in the true mode of goodness, the person is thinking, this should be done. It's the right thing to do. And similarly, charity, dātavyam iti jadana, diyate nupakarne. When you give something in charity to someone who's not going to give you anything in return, perhaps they may not even be grateful. If you give to someone who's not going to give you something in return, and why do you do it? Dātavyam. Because it's the right thing to do. It should be given. That's the mode of goodness. So, anyway, in householder life, it's really meant to cultivate goodness. And the basis of it, of course, is mutual respect. And it's hard to respect someone who's a partner in crime. So the extent to which people are not honoring their mutual commitment to help each other spiritually, they lose respect for themselves and for each other. And therefore, you don't feel good in that association. And that's why the marriage is endangered. Because if you don't feel good about yourself in a particular situation, and you can't respect yourself when you see yourself in a particular situation, or if you can't respect the other person, then without that respect, the endorphins, as we all know or should know, they're the first to go. The love endorphins. So, endorphins won't buy me love. So actually, householder life is meant to cultivate real love. It's actually romantic in a sense. If you really, you know what real romance is. Real romance doesn't mean, you have got such a cool body. You have such a cute face. Yeah, and I love your body. And I love your face, especially after those three rounds of cosmetic surgery. So, I mean, real love is, means you actually love the person. You actually love the person. So householder life and sannyas life and brahmachari life, actually, the real qualification to go back to the spiritual world is to have real love, Krishna prema. But to love Krishna is to love everyone. And really, in terms of the cost to you, loving Krishna purely or loving someone else purely, it's kind of the same. In the sense that in both cases, you have to give up your false ego, you have to give up your selfishness. And so that's why Krishna says in the Gita, that this knowledge is like the sun. If you think like the sun rising, everything becomes illumined at once. So it's really that you either love or don't love. And if you love anyone, you love everyone. And if you don't love a particular person, you don't love anyone. So, like if you love one soul, if you truly love a soul, and it's not just attachment, then you learn to love everyone. It's just like, who would believe it if a mother or father says, I love some of my children, but not all of them, but it's real love. You know what I mean? I mean, somehow it just doesn't sound right. Because you either are a loving parent, or you're not a loving parent. And, you know, one of your kids may be, well, semi-lemonic. I mean, you know, people have different children, and some of them may achieve more than others.
Don't shine as bright as the others.
Yeah. But the point is, loving parents tell their children that we love our children equally, and they actually mean it. They actually mean it. So, it's not that, well, I love this child, not that child. You either are a loving parent or you're not. And in a higher sense, you either are a loving person or you're not. Because you can't truly love in the bodily concept of life, because you're just not getting it. I mean, you could, you know, it's a reflection of love. There's something, it's sort of like a version of love, which is mixed with a bunch of, you know, good. But the point is, when you really love, it's not in the bodily concept of life. And so if you really love, on what ground wouldn't you love someone else? You may think their false ego is incredibly obnoxious. And you may, like, it may be intolerable if you just spend 5 minutes in the company of that person, but it doesn't mean you don't love. You may love them at a very remote distance. So, but still, the idea is that if we actually love, then we love. And so you can't love Krishna unless you love other souls. You can't love other souls unless you love Krishna. It's just either you love or you don't, or you love to a certain extent. And you can almost do the numbers, like the emotions you feel towards others. What percentage is love? What percentage is the bodily concept of life? What percentage is pride? And so that's what marriage is for. That's what everything is for. The whole Vedic culture is to bring us to the point of pure love, which is not just gushy and sentimental. I mean, real love can manifest in courageous, violent acts, defending people. Real love can manifest in intellectual brilliance. It can manifest in all kinds of ways. It's not just a sentimental, syrupy state that makes grown men leave the room. I mean, it's love can manifest in many different ways, but one of the most important manifestations of love, of all, is loyalty. Like Krishna. Imagine Krishna's loyalty, that he's still in our heart. I mean, after all we've done and haven't done, Krishna's still in our heart. So just staying with the person is actually perhaps the greatest act of love. And so that's why fidelity in marriage is very important. I mean, within reasonable boundaries. I mean, if you discover your spouse is a psychotic serial killer or something, you may want to, you know, live at least one apartment over. So, but that's why in marriage, the loyalty, the faith, because in being loyal to a spouse, we are actually following Krishna's own example, his loyalty to us, by remaining in our hearts, despite all of our absurd activities. So, anyway, so everything ultimately is modeled on Krishna. Krishna himself sets the example, not simply in the sense that he gets married and, you know, gets up at a certain time, performs certain duties, but just in the sense of Krishna's loyalty to us, his compassion, his dedication. Main thing is be spiritual. So, any questions on these points? Yes.
In the Mahabharata, from what I understand, Draupadi is a pure devotee, but she favors Arjuna more than the other Pandavas?
Not according to the Mahabharata.
No. I retract my comment.
I mean, Draupadi was quite chaste. In fact, Draupadi's genius and her greatness, among many other things, is that she could actually pull it off. As women know, I mean, dealing with one male ego is amazing. And so, of course, not that the Pandavas have mundane false egos or pure devotees, but still, I mean, to be a wife is, it's a job. So to have 5 husbands is, yeah, the fact that she could do that, and she could be so perfect in her behavior that she brought them together. Because an ordinary woman with 5 guys would separate them. But she actually brought all the brothers together by her perfect behavior. Anything else? Of course, polyandry is no longer an option, legal option. If not, then I guess you can go back into the oven.